It's my contention, and obviously that's what these charts that are up here suggest. It's my contention that each of the parties has some very real and important interests in peace, but that each of the parties also has some real and important constraints on how boldly they pursue peace, or how eagerly they pursue peace. Today, the topic we're going to look at is the topic, sort of really the subtopic of the whole week, and that is peace really possible? It's a very simple kind of question, but I think about this conflict, the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's a question that is still, whether you're an expert about the Middle East or someone who just tries to keep up with things or has a kind of dim interest in what's going on, it's a question that's very hard to answer positively. That is to say, I think it is quite almost universal among people, whether experts, whether people in the conflict directly or observers of the conflict from some distance, that pessimism about this conflict comes more naturally than optimism. So it seemed to me a good idea to look at the question rather directly, is peace really possible? Someone asked me, I think they were wanting to go on to another class this afternoon, if I couldn't answer the question before the class begins, so they could go on, and I did, and the answer was yes, maybe. And they stayed for whatever reasons, I don't know, because by the end of the hour, I think that's the answer you'll probably have anyway. But in October of 1991, the same year, interestingly, that the United States-led coalition fought a war against Iraq to push Iraq out of Kuwait, in that same year, at the end of that year, in October, the Madrid Peace Conference was convened. It was convened as a result of invitations sent by the United States and the then Soviet Union to the parties, including all the parties that are up here, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, the Palestinians, and Israel, to attend a conference under the auspices of the United States and Soviet Union in order to negotiate a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. It's the first time that such a conference has been convened in the entire history of this conflict. And when I say the first time, I mean the first time that all of the parties came to the conference. It should be noted, and we might want to come back to this in some of our discussion today, that the Palestinians did not come as a separate delegation, but came as part of a Jordanian-Palestinian delegation, which was something that had been insisted upon by the Israelis and that the U.S. accepted as a host and the Soviet Union accepted and that the Palestinians accepted. It was, in the eyes of many, including I think the Israelis, rather a thin fig leaf over the reality that the Israelis were going to be negotiating with the Palestinians, but it was a fig leaf that was helpful politically in Israel to, in a way, cover the behind, if you'll excuse the expression, of the very conservative Israeli government, who was not wanting to have to explain to its constituency why it was negotiating with the Palestinians. So it could say it was negotiating with, really with Jordan, and the Palestinians were part of the Jordanian delegation. So, but that's the first time that a conference was convened, where all of the parties attended. That conference then initiated a peace process in two parts, one called the bilateral negotiations, which means negotiations between Jordan and the Palestinians and Israel, Syria and Israel, Lebanon and Israel. Egypt was there more as a kind of observer and helper because they'd already negotiated peace. The bilateral negotiations have been going on a regular basis in Washington, D.C. And then at a second level, the peace conference initiated what's called the multilateral negotiations, which involve all of these parties, plus Saudi Arabia, plus Japan, plus China, plus the European Economic Community, plus a couple of other that I'm just fogging on, in talks on a range of issues that relate to what would have to be discussed if there was peace between these parties. Issues such as the environment, environmental issues in the Middle East. Issues such as arms control in the Middle East. Economic cooperation. Water resources. Refugees. Issues which in a certain sense can't even be discussed until there's some basic negotiated peace between the parties. But it was an interesting and I think a very creative approach that the U.S., particularly the U.S., this was a U.S. idea, took in deciding when they initiated the peace conference that they wanted a peace process and immediately to begin that would be dealing on the hard bilateral negotiations, but also at the same time talking about these issues, which in a way could begin to pull people's and parties' attention toward a future that assumed that there would be peace. Many journalists who wrote about the Madrid Peace Conference at the time and wrote about the peace process since have focused on two reasons why these peace talks, peace negotiations, are possible now and were not possible earlier. And the two reasons I think have real merit. I mean, they are reasons, they are very important, and I'll mention them briefly, but then want to go on to three other reasons that I want to talk about. The two that have been focused on, interestingly enough, are more at the international or global level and at the regional level, rather than at the level of what changes have taken place among the parties to make them willing to go into negotiations now. The first reason was the end of the Cold War. That is the fact, I think it's a fact, that as long as the Cold War was on, both the United States and the Soviet Union tended to view this conflict, the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as much as a vehicle for carrying on their contest with each other, as they did as a conflict of peoples who were suffering from it, which needed help to be resolved. And indeed, if you look back over the history of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you will see many instances where the Soviet Union and or the United States used the conflict, used the parties, used particular events that were happening in order to gain advantage over the other superpower. And frankly, though I wish I could say this is not true, I think you would have to say as you look back over that history that the United States is at least as responsible for doing that kind of approaching this conflict in that way as was the Soviet Union. That we tended to use it more than try to resolve it. But as a reason why there could be a peace process now, many journalists, and I think rightly so, have pointed to the fact that when the Cold War ended, there was a possibility that the Soviet Union and the United States would cooperate with each other in seeking a resolution to the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and indeed that happened. From the point of view of the parties themselves, once the Cold War ended, the parties had to acknowledge and accept the fact that they could no longer use the Cold War as a way of gaining leverage with once gaining, for instance, aid from one superpower as a way to serve that superpower's interest against the other superpower. And I say it in those terms because it's not just Israel which used the Cold War in a way to get more aid from the United States, but Syria which used the Cold War in exactly the same way to get more aid from the Soviet Union. Once the Cold War is over, neither the superpowers nor the parties themselves can play that game anymore. So that is a reason why peace is more possible today than it was before. A second factor, which many journalists pointed to as to why this peace process started when it did, is indeed, in fact, the war with Iraq. And the reason for that, again, it's helpful, I think, to look at your big map, the single map, if you have it. If you don't, you might want to, let me see how many there are. When we run out of maps, the class is over. put a hand up or something if you don't. Anybody else? Back? Can you pass a couple back that way? Here's another one. There's one. All right. Person over there. Just look at the map and look at Iraq. Look at Iraq. On the map, that's just a single map, not the one where there's two maps side by side. And look at Iraq.
No, that's right.
Iraq is a huge country. First of all, it's a huge country. It's a country with tremendous oil wealth. It is also a tremendous military power in the region in terms of what I'm measuring, you know, number of tanks, number of missiles, number of troops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It does not border on Israel, but it has been a constant source of support and, if you will, even provocation in terms of the war against Israel since 1948. It has, in every war, at least supplied token numbers of troops or military hardware. It has certainly given its endorsement of the wars against Israel. And the theory of the importance of Iraq in the war against Israel, in Arab theory, is that Iraq provides what is called strategic depth to the Arab side. That is to say, it's not right there on the front lines, but it's there in the background with tremendous resources, economic and military, which could be brought to bear in a war, a new war with Israel. And what the analysts say, and I think correctly, is that with the military defeat of Iraq, never mind the fact that Saddam Hussein stayed in power, but with the military defeat of Iraq and the tremendous now way in which Iraq is set back as a military power as a result of the Gulf War, this was another reason why, on the Arab side, there was a kind of acceptance of the fact that we have to work toward a negotiated solution with Israel, because this tremendous military resource had been so smashed. Now, I would say that, in fact, and I'll say a little bit more about this later, that, in fact, many Arabs and many Arab leaders had come to conclusions that defeating Israel militarily was impossible at an earlier time than 1991. But this was another blow in pushing people's thinking in the same direction. So this is often cited as a second factor why the parties were at the talks. The first being that, after all, when the U.S. and Soviet Union invite them together, in a certain sense, they can't play one off the other, so they have to say, yes, we'll come, because the Cold War had ended. And number two, that with the defeat of Iraq, the military destruction of Iraq, there was even less credibility to the idea that eventually the Arabs would have enough military power and put it to use in a way that could defeat Israel. Now, I said, those two reasons are at an international level and a regional level, but what I want to talk about is why the parties came, that has to do with how people see things in those societies, in these societies, which have been in conflict and which are in conflict. The first, and let me say that the reasons that I'm going to give, particularly the first two, are not the kind of reasons, at least in my mind, that Judy Collins or Joan Baez would write a folk song about. That is to say, they have relatively little to do with idealism, relatively little to do with a seeking peace in an idealistic sense. They are, in my mind, not necessarily any less moral reasons for that. But I want to be clear, particularly, you know, as sometimes when we think of peace, we think only of idealism, or we think only of sort of the aspiration to be good with each other, and which is all important, terribly, terribly important. And I'm not saying it's absent in this peace process, but I'm going to suggest that it isn't the main motivation that brings the parties to the table. The first reason, in terms of the actual parties and peoples, why I think the peace process began and has continued, not succeeded, but continued, for these 2 years, is that people on both sides of this conflict are sick and tired of it. Sick and tired of it. They have fought, after all, when we had our chronology up here, the first session, they have fought how many wars? 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, 1982. Not even counting the war with Iraq, which was not fundamentally about the Arab-Israeli conflict. They fought those wars, and even more depressing than just the fact that they fought those 5 wars is that at the end of those wars, the conflict is not fundamentally different than it was before the first war. And that is an incredibly depressing fact. I mean, some of you who have been in war or had family members who have been in war, and I'm thinking now more of the Second World War than Vietnam, but say the Second World War or Korea. Korea may be more like this in some ways, but say the Second World War, you know, with all the suffering, with all the fear, with all the pain, with all the hurt, at least at the end of the war, World War II, you could say, well, the world is safer. because Nazism, fascism has been defeated. But in this case, the reasons for which both sides fought all those wars have not come to be. They have not materialized. They have not reached them. What are the reasons? On the Arab side, basically, the Arabs fought these wars against Israel because they believed that the formation and creation of Israel was a fundamental injustice to Arabs in general and Palestinians in particular. And therefore, their goal in fighting the wars fundamentally was to undo that injustice, which is, to put it directly, to get rid of Israel. And yet, after every war, Israel was still there and, to rub it in, had won every one of the wars. On the Israeli side, why did they fight the wars? They fought the wars to make Israel safe and secure as a state, as a homeland, as a Jewish state, as a homeland for the Jewish people. And yet, after every war, which ironically they won, Israel was still not safe and secure. So that the normal amount of being sick and tired of war that anybody experiences, even in a war that seems to accomplish its goal, in this case, is multiplied in two ways. One, there have been five wars, and two, the frustration and being sick and tired is multiplied because at the end of all the wars, the situation is fundamentally not different than it was before. Moreover, most people, whether Arab or Israeli, have a sense. Some have a sense and some have actually quite articulated theories about it, that is the strategists and analysts, and the ordinary people have a sense about it, that if there's not a negotiated peace, there will very likely be another war. And the think tank people believe that the next war most likely will be focused between Israel and Syria. In part because Egypt is out of it, for at least temporarily, because it made peace. And Syria is the only other power bordering on Israel that has anything near the military capacity that it would dare think of a war with Israel. And Syria, in fact, in recent years has gotten new missiles. So that one of the factors with the, quote, advancement of technology is that the next war is always technologically more advanced than the last one, which basically means more people can suffer more quickly. And in this case, what I'm talking about is that Syria now has missiles that can reach Tel Aviv, where in the 1973 war, the last time there was a direct war between Syria and Israel, not counting the 82 one where it was indirect in Lebanon, Syria didn't have such missiles. Now they have them. And if there's a war, they're likely to use them. Now, it's interesting, when you talk with Syria, as Carol and I have done, Syrian military experts and Israeli military experts, they have relatively close views to each other as to how the war will go. You know, it's almost like, I think this is bizarre, you know. You almost wish that there was some more illusion in it, because it seems even more cruel and inhuman, you know, when they can sit around and they know what's going to happen. And they agree, the Syrians and the Israelis agree, that the war will be relatively short, partly because the technology means incredible destruction very fast, and partly because they agree that Israel will quickly win it. The Syrian military people agree. But the Syrians say, and the Israelis agree, that they will inflict more destruction on Israel than they ever have in other wars before. And in that sense, there will be something that Syria will get out of. And people have a sense of this. The experts talk about it in these sort of strategic scientific terms, but people have a sense of it. They have a sense that if there's not negotiated peace, there'll be another war, and they have a sense, as the experts have just suggested, that at the end of the war, the situation will not fundamentally have changed. Now, it's more than that in terms of people being sick and tired of it. It's also people understanding cumulatively the costs of these wars and the preparations for the next war on their societies. Costs in terms of economic and social development not carried out or suspended or carried out in weaker, less effective ways because so much of the energies and brain power and whatever science and money and resources of the societies are going into defending themselves. Yes.
What influence in all of this, and also in bringing these nations together in Madrid and subsequent dialogues, has the Iran-Iraq war had upon all of this scene? Or has it?
Well, it's not direct. I mean, I think one of the things that the Iran-Iraq war helped everybody to understand, whether you're in the Middle East or not, is that when we say Middle East, we frequently think only of the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian issue. And one thing that Iran-Iraq reminded us is there are other problems and other conflicts and other awful possibilities that don't fundamentally have to do with Arabs and Israelis. It also, I think, people were conscious of the tremendous insanity and human toll and insanity of that war. You know, 1.5 million people died in that war. And when you got to the end of that war, in terms of what the goals were, you know, millimeters of grasslands, if that. So people, I think, saw it as an insanity. I think they also saw that, they saw it, and rightly so, as an example of how much the superpowers cared. Because there was a war that the superpowers basically were content with each country destroying the other. The United States and Soviet Union. They were content. From the U.S. point of view, Iraq, which had sort of been close to the Soviet Union, it was good that if Iran could cut Iraq down to size, you know, weaken a client of the Soviet Union. From both the Soviet Union and the United States points of view, anything that could do harm to the Iranian Revolution, which seemed quite threatening both to the Russians and to the Americans, was a good thing. So in a certain sense, if you look at the history of that war, look at policy maneuvering and various machinations that went on, and basically you'd have to say that there was very little effort by the superpowers to end the war, and to some extent there was even a kind of a gentle, passive encouragement for it. And in some cases, not so passive. I mean, arms and other things. So I think another thing that people in the region perceived was that here was an example of an awfully destructive war, and the superpowers sort of sitting back and sort of took any sort of idea about the superpowers having the good interests of people there at heart. You know, took that down a few pegs. But what I was speaking about, just in terms of another layer of this sick and tiredness, is the economic and social aspect. People are sick and tired of the cost of the war in terms of their societies, in terms of the quality of life that they have, whether they're Israelis or Syrians or Palestinians, for sure, you know. They all are aware of how much the toll these wars take. And I think I mentioned yesterday, and I'll mention again, because I think it's an interesting and very important fact, that business leaders in all of the countries, although I'm particularly conscious of certain people that I know and that I've read about, know personally and have read about, in Syria and in Israel, business leaders are among the strongest supporters of the peace process. Saying, you know, I mean, for instance, one man that we knew who was on the board of Syrian Airlines who said, you know, there's no chance of Syria, which has, by the way, a much more favorable situation, say, than Egypt in terms of population and resources. The population of Syria is only about 11 million people, 4 million in the capital. Well, compared to its resources, that's not bad in terms of potential development and to have a good life in terms of goods and services and so forth. But this man who's Syrian Airlines said there's no chance of that development occurring in the way that it could potentially until there's a negotiated solution with Israel. And Israeli business leaders, even during when the Likud government was in power, who were interviewed, said the same thing. Said there's no way, for instance, we can deal with the flood of Russian Jews who have come into Israel unless we can commit resources to it. Unless we're putting money into economic development, which right now we can't put in because we're too squeezed by the military budget. So there's that aspect also of people being sick and tired of the conflict. But just to, I guess this is where the maybe comes in. If that much of what I've said says yes, peace is more possible, here's where the maybe comes in. I am convinced, and I don't even think it's not a theoretical thing. I mean, I think it's sort of pretty bedrock in terms of how people work, that the same sick and tiredness that people feel on both sides with this conflict that makes them want the peace process to continue and to succeed, that same sick and tiredness is the fuel for extremist movements. And that's sort of, it sounds a little funny because they obviously go in very different directions in terms of the results they produce. But what I'm suggesting is that people get to a point where they're sick and tired of it. They want it to end, so they're looking for something new to try to end it. They're not satisfied with the old answers. On the Israeli side, we'll have a strong military, we will take care of the terrorists, we will attack twice as hard if anybody attacks us, and that will be the answer for the future. People aren't satisfied with it as an answer. On the Arab side, the next war we will win, and we will gloriously, we will return our glory and defeat, and Muslim glory, and we will defeat the Zionists, blah, blah, blah. People aren't satisfied with the answers because they've been through enough history that it hasn't worked. But that sick and tiredness also makes them vulnerable, as it would make us vulnerable, I think, to appeals by extremist leaders that have the answer, religious answer. The reason we have not defeated Zionism is because we have not followed the way of Allah. If we follow the true way of Allah, as our leaders do not, they are corrupt. They are not true Muslims. If we follow the true way of Allah, we will defeat Israel and Allah will deliver us gloriously. People are drawn to it. You know, I think sometimes we have the idea that extremists are born that way. I think it makes it easier for us to deal with them in a way because it makes them sort of monsters and sort of special people that we can have in a category, you know, extremists. My sense of extremists is that they're people like us who have had experiences different than ours, who at a certain point feel driven to some extreme alternative. And what I'm saying here is that this very same sick and tiredness, this very same frustration that people feel that when the leaders of these parties got their invitations to go to Madrid, if any one of them had turned down the invitation, whether Shamir in Israel or Assad in Syria, that there would have been a strong popular reaction against that, or wondering why. It would have taken different expression. In Israel, there would have been big demonstrations. In Syria, there would have been discontent among important elites. But it's still a reality. And there also would have been discontent among people, though it wouldn't have been given expression because Syria doesn't work that way. But every leader, I think, had to say yes to the peace process in part because of this great frustration and desperate feeling of sick and tiredness people feel. But if the peace process keeps going on and doesn't produce any result, I believe that that same frustration is the fuel bed for the extremist movements that are growing on both sides who have other answers to this conflict. As I said to someone, you know, they said, I can't imagine that Yitzhak Shamir, you know, can possibly negotiate an agreement with Yasser Arafat. It's impossible. Or even Rabin, the current Israeli prime minister, that he can negotiate an agreement with Arafat. It's impossible. I said, well, if you think that's difficult, wait till we get to the negotiations between Rabbi Kahana and Khomeini. Because that's the next round, you know? That's the next round. So that's the first reason. I think peace is more possible in terms of what's happened among the parties. People are sick and tired of it. The wars, the suffering, the future wars, the economic toll, the social toll, and so forth. And again, I say, I don't think that's the kind of thing that Judy Collins would write a folk song about. And it's not, I'm a Judy Collins fan, so I don't say it in a negative way about Judy Collins, but I am saying it in a little bit of a part humorous way about sometimes our attitude about what's peace is based on, you know, sort of only on idealism. And I think it's also based on what seems to me a very important morally based perception. And this is where I want to come back. I don't want to make these people sound like somehow they're morally on a lower level because they're motivated by what I've been talking about, they're being sick and tired of the conflict, than we would be, or than somebody would be who's motivated by a sense of peace is the way God commands. Because it seems to me God's commandment comes through realities too. God's commandment comes through realities too. The world teaches, history teaches, you know? And to me it's a sign that people are in some sense tuned in to the created order that God intends, that after these wars people come to a sense of being sick and tired and we must find another way. That's not less moral in my book than a kind of a sort of wishing and that sense that peace is the right way and only the right way. Second reason is that each of the parties, or let me say that the two parties on the two sides, Israel on one side, the Arab states and the Palestinians on the other, have come gradually to accept the fact that the other side is here to stay. Now when you say that, it should immediately signal that this is not your usual conflict. Because most conflicts are not conflicts about whether the other side should exist. Thank God, you know. Thank God most conflicts are not conflicts about whether the other side should exist. Most conflicts are conflicts of less or more. Even the conflict in Namibia and South Africa, as bitter, as much suffering as the conflict and the apartheid system, basically is a conflict about who will control. Will it be majority of the population? Will it be whites only? You know, that's a less or more conflict. It's a desperately hard conflict. It's a bitter conflict. It's a long conflict. But it's not a conflict about whether the other side should exist. This conflict has been a conflict for almost 40 years, more than 40 years in some sense, between two sides which said the other side shouldn't exist. And what do I mean? I mean pretty simple, straightforward things. That on the Arab side, as I said earlier, in terms of the wars, that the Arab peoples and Arab leaders believe that the creation of Israel was a fundamentally unjust thing and should be undone. Should be undone. And the Palestinians, whose, remember, the map is the same shape, it's the same map. This is Palestine, this is Israel. And for the Palestinians, when Israel is created, Palestine is destroyed, and therefore Palestine to be liberated, Israel must be destroyed. Not all the Jews killed. And as the Palestinian movement has evolved, it's said at various points Jews can stay here, who came before a certain date. Then they say, well, Jews can stay here, but they have to live in a secular state with Palestinians. But there just can't be a Jewish state here. It's going to be an Arab-Muslim state. So Arabs have wanted Israel to disappear. Well, now, from an Israeli point of view, there's not much to talk about. You know, as long as the other side, basically, in the position is you should disappear, what are the Israelis got to talk about? And in Arab propaganda, and in Arab statements, and in Arab policies, this has been a constant theme in most of Arab policies and Palestinian policies, PLO policies, for years, most of the years of this conflict. That's why when Sadat did what he did, it was so dramatic. All he did was say, I'm willing to go to Jerusalem and talk about peace. It was dramatic because he was essentially saying, you're going to be there, and I'm going to come, I'm going to talk about how to make peace. What about the Israelis? Did they somehow, Israeli Jews, somehow have the idea or goal that the Arabs should disappear? No. I mean, they're not crazy. You're talking about 150 million, now maybe 200 million people in 11 countries all throughout the Middle East and North Africa. No, not the Arabs, but the Palestinians. Yes. Yes, in a certain sense, deep in the Israeli Jewish psyche and is a wish that the Palestinians would disappear. Why? Come back to the map. Come back to the map. It's the same map. It's the same place. And for Jews to feel good about having created a Jewish homeland, the Palestinians shouldn't have been there, to put it in a looking back way. They shouldn't have been there. And indeed, certain Jewish and Israeli Jewish myths about the creation of Israel have even suggested that they weren't. What's the expression of creating something out of a desert? I can't. Making the desert bloom. Making the desert bloom, you know. Well, if you've been to Israel, a lot of it's not desert, first of all. And even the rocky parts, there were Palestinians living there for centuries, farming olives and grapes and other things, and this was their home. But I think deep in the Israeli, not, you know, and what I mean by disappear, do I mean exterminate the Palestinians? No, I don't think so. I think the Israeli thoughts on this are reasonably clear and available if you look at materials and history books and newspapers and so forth and talk to Jews and Israelis. One idea Israeli Jews had about how the Palestinians might disappear is they would disappear into all the Arab countries that were around Israel. And in a way, that's not an unreasonable thing for Israelis to wish, in the sense that, after all, Palestinians shared a language, shared a culture, shared a history with those Arabs. Indeed, in the early part of the century, there wasn't so much separate nationalisms, Syrian, Jordanian, Palestinian, etc. There was more Arab nationalism. And so Israelis were not, you know, creating something far-fetched to dream, to hope, to think that the Palestinians could disappear. So you'll hear Jews say, or Israeli Jews say, well, why couldn't the Arab states have taken care of the Palestinians? Why couldn't, many Palestinians fled there, why couldn't they have taken care of them? After all, we took care of a lot of our refugees, that sort of sense. The problem with that is very simple. The Palestinians wanted to go home. It's just very simple. The best theory of how it might have worked that the Arab states would have absorbed the Palestinians falls down on that hard fact that the Palestinians wanted to be in Haifa and Acre and Jerusalem and Nablus. Yes?
This implies an interesting question. I wonder if you'd comment on that. There may very well be an important dynamic here of the Israelis feeling guilt at some level and how that operates. Would you say something about that?
What I'd say is feeling guilt in the sense of identifying it themselves as such, no. By and large, no. I've met Israelis, although it took Carol and I quite a while before we met an Israeli, and we have met many wonderful Israelis who are for sure a part of making any solution that's going to be possible, and have been for some years. But it took us many, many months before we met an Israeli who volunteered to talk about 1948 in his sense that a grave injustice had been done to the Palestinians. I don't think guilt, and I think it's very important to try to understand why not. Just as I think it's important for people to understand how could a people who had been through such awful experiences deliver such awful experiences on another people? And one way I come to understand that is, I think I can understand after the Holocaust, when Jews say never again, that they not only mean that the Holocaust should never happen again, but that never again, in a certain sense, are they accountable to others. Because when left in the hands of others, they were headed toward extermination, and very little was done to stop it. And so having had that tremendous experience, awful experience of abandonment by others, in a certain sense, there's a psychological, not necessarily intellectual, not necessarily articulated, but a psychological sense in which Jews say to others, you never can hold us accountable for immorality again. Now, it's wrong. Judaism, of course, teaches nothing like that. It's wrong, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work. But I think I can understand it. I think I can understand why Israelis who come out of that World War II Nazi experience, coming to this land, seeking to have a homeland, finding this hostility, just put any moral questions about it aside. I think I can understand that. It doesn't help them, although one could say maybe it was necessary at that point, I don't know, but in the long run it sure doesn't help. But I think that's what the Israelis really wish, that the Palestinians weren't there, that they wouldn't, that somehow they'd go away. And one way they could go away is go into the other Arab countries. The other way they could go away is stay. And you know that many Palestinians stayed. Some 300,000 to 400,000 Palestinian Arabs stayed inside Israel when it was created. And Israeli citizenship was granted to them, sort of second-class status as citizens, but citizens with voting rights, for example, an important mark of citizenship in any democratic society. And so this way that Israelis hope Palestinians might disappear is to stay but be a quiet minority. So similarly, when Israelis took the West Bank and Gaza, I think there was a kind of wish among some Israelis and a sort of expectation that Palestinians would accept it, would be quiet, wouldn't raise their flag, wouldn't raise their voice, wouldn't organize national meetings, wouldn't have national aspirations anymore, that somehow they would disappear in that sense. Now, why did the Arabs change their mind about coming to the view that Israel's here to stay? I wish I could say it was because of idealism, a sense of Arabs coming to understand the needs of the Jewish people, the aspirations of the Jewish people. And indeed, there are some Arabs who do that, and it's amazing to hear them. That is, I have a person that Carol and I know fairly well, one of the PLO leaders, who, when I took this group to meet him in Cairo, he spoke, and I've heard him speak publicly in this vein, where he speaks about how he, as a Palestinian Arab, has come to understand Jewish aspirations. And it's incredibly moving. It's also in a certain sense, you have to say it's surprising. In other words, you know, when people have suffered so much at the hand of another people, one has to wonder at their capacity to somehow not only keep their own suffering in view and their own aspirations and their struggle against this people, but at the same time somehow come to understand the aspirations of those people who have been their oppressors and torturers in a certain sense. But I wish I could say that that's why Arabs have come to the sense that Israel's here to stay. I think more to the point is that they fought five wars and lost.
No.
I wish it were different. I wish they could have fought one and come to the same realization or not have had to fight any. But I think that really is a major part of how Arab leaders and people came to accept that Israel's here to stay. That each time they tried, there was a war, whoever started it, and the goal was in part to try to destroy Israel, they lost. And so they came, Egyptian leadership first publicly, to the conclusion that Israel's here to stay and we have to reach a negotiated solution with Israel. What about the Israelis? What convinced them? Understanding Palestinian aspirations, kind of guilt coming out in a creative way? Yes, for some Israelis. And again, there are Israelis that are quite amazing at the capacity to understand and stand with the Palestinians even while they are standing with Israel. In other words, they don't desert Israel to stand with the Palestinians. But I think more to the point of why the Israelis have come to the point where they accept that we have to negotiate with the Palestinians is that the Palestinians didn't disappear. That the Palestinians didn't disappear. They never won a war. They never hardly even won a battle against the Israelis. But they didn't disappear. In 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, part of the theory of Israelis who were in favor of that war, including the defense minister Ariel Sharon, was that if the Israeli military went into Lebanon and defeated the PLO military power in Lebanon, and there was a significant military power for the Palestinians compared to Israel, it was nothing. I mean, it was like, you know, it was Katusha rockets against F-16s. I mean, it wasn't exactly a match in any sense militarily. But the Palestinians had built up a nasty military base there and could launch rockets over the border. And the Israeli theory was that we go in and we destroy Palestinian military capacity and that this will cause the disappearance in time of Palestinian nationalism. 1982, the Israelis did defeat the Palestinians militarily. And interesting, by the way, some Palestinians believe that that might cause that to happen too. I mean, they thought that military power was essential to their capacity to bring Israel to face the Palestinian issue. They thought it was essential. Well, it was destroyed, effectively, in 1982. And yet, Palestinian nationalism, if anything, rose in its power. Power, or at least its presence, not only power in military terms, but its presence. And in 1987, as you know, the Palestinian uprising erupted in the West Bank and Gaza called the Intifada. And here, after the military had been defeated, essentially teenage kids who went in the streets, most of them or many of them against their parents' wishes, to throw stones at Israeli jeeps, a rather losing proposition on a military level. That intifada, combined with the results of the war in Lebanon, where Palestinian nationalism didn't disappear, I think persuaded Israelis that Palestinians are here to stay. And so what I'm saying is the second reason why the talks are on, why there's a possibility today that wasn't here 5-10 years ago, is that on each side, there is a gradual and grudging acceptance that the other side is here to stay. And it's very important to understand it's grudging. I mean, part of my job, I speak in many synagogues and mosques or Arab American meetings of Arab Americans. And I always get a question, or almost always get a question in a synagogue, well, do you think that the Arabs or the Palestinians really accept Israel's right to be there? My answer is no. Very simply, no. I wish I could say yes. But I think the answer is no, in terms of what people wish, in terms of what's in their hearts or their guts, what they would like to be, is they would like Israel not to be. And that's still true today. There's a PLO leader who's now, I think, the representative in Lebanon, Shafiq al-Hut, who's been an outspoken for 10, 15 years within the PLO for a two-state solution. That is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel. So he's been advocating this for 10, 15 years. And once we took a group of Jewish Christian Muslim leaders to meet him at the UN when Arafat was supposed to come and was denied a visa and had to go to Geneva and all that business. We took this group to meet Shafiq Alun, and he was explaining the PLO position, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the rabbis got kind of frustrated with him and was asking him some hard questions about why can't the PLO do this and this. And Shafiq was saying, look, we've done what we can right now, and then let me say more. If you're going to get upset, I feel I can now get a little bit upset. It was an interesting dynamic. Like the rabbi, by getting angry, gave the PLO guy permission to get angry, you know? And as Shafiq Alun said, my family is from Haifa. You know, Haifa's on the coast. It's not in the West Bank or Gaza where the Palestinians might get a state. He said, my family's from Haifa. He said, if my father were alive today and alive and knew that I was advocating the acceptance of Israel and a small Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, he would take me, as old as he might be, by the neck, and he would slap my face and push me out of the house and say, I never want to see you in my eyes again because you have given up your father's land, your grandfather's land, your great-grandfather's land to the Zionists. So, have the Arabs, have the Palestinians accepted Israel's right to be there? I don't think so. Has Israel accepted that the Palestinians are a people who lived in this land, who have claims as deep and as legitimate and as moral and as true as Jewish claims to this land? No. No. What they've accepted is that the other side is here to stay. And that necessity forces them to say, we have to negotiate a solution or else our children and grandchildren. And this would be Shafiq's answer to his father. You talk about my giving up your father, your land, and your grandfather's land. I talk about what future I want for my son and his son. This is the way the Palestinian would say it. Excuse me. Probably this is the way Shafiq would say it. He would not talk about his daughter or his mother's land. So understand what I'm doing here. Do not send me off on the boat. But I think that's the way Shafiq Alhoub will do it. And he's an incredibly wonderful human being who hasn't made that transition yet. He hasn't made that change yet. Certainly not when he's angry. And he's thinking of his father. And on the Israeli side, Israelis who believe that the West Bank and Gaza, who know that the West Bank is the land where biblical Israel was, where the patriarch Abraham is buried, supposedly, on the edge of a large Palestinian city, which if this solution comes about will not be a Jewishly controlled city. It will be a Palestinian controlled city. And Abraham's buried there. And so Jews who in a certain sense feel a strong sense of legitimate claim to that land as well as Haifa and Acre say, yes, but at what price of blood, Jew and non-Jew? And there are literally Orthodox rabbis in Israel who argue these things. And of course, then it's argued in a secular version of the same argument. That is to say, when it comes to saving life is more important than holding on to all the land. So that's the second reason. And the third is a little bit more upbeat, and I can do it quickly, and that is that, you know, compared to 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was involved with the Quakers in some of the early meetings of some Israelis and Palestinians, and both Israelis and Palestinians were afraid to even meet with each other. Partly they were afraid because they hadn't met each other and they were nervous about what the person would be like. Partly they were afraid because they were afraid it would be found out in their own communities and that they'd lose their position or influence, or in the Palestinian cases, their position or influence or even their lives. And we, Carol and I, know a Palestinian, a marvelous, marvelous man who was the mayor of Hebron, who the Israelis deported to Jordan. He was an open advocate of a two-state solution, negotiations with Israel. As I said to Israelis, one could wish that all one's enemies were as decent as this man. And he was killed in Amman by Palestinian extremists because he advocated peace with Israel in front of his four-year-old son. So people risked a lot in the early days to just even talk with each other. Now, today, there's a journal published quarterly which lists all the meetings that are occurring around the world, and probably doesn't list many of them because they haven't found out about them, between Arabs and Israelis talking about a variety of issues of cooperation and future. To me, that's an extraordinary change The American Academy for the Advancement of Science has held a series of meetings in the Middle East and in Europe and in the U.S., bringing together Arab and Israeli, Palestinian and Israeli scholars to talk about various issues of the future, and have published common papers. Here's a book that is written by a very prominent Palestinian who's in charge of some aspects of the peace process negotiating for the negotiating team, Sari Nusseibeh and Mark Heller, a rather prestigious, youngish, but prestigious professor at Tel Aviv, called No Trumpets, No Drums, A Two-State Settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. And they wrote it together. Hmm. They each have their say in the beginning and say basically how hard it is to work with this other guy. But then they write a series of chapters about a solution, and they write it together. So what I'm saying is the last thing that I'm suggesting as a sign that peace is more possible today than it was is that people are meeting and talking, not only the officials, not only the negotiating team, but they're doing it for their governments and for the PLO, but in fact, people are meeting and talking and beginning to not only envision, but actually write and plan a common future. So yes, I think peace is possible. I think when we come, for those of us who come tomorrow's session, it's very important that we see how the U.S. fits into this. Because if peace is possible, my sense is that it is only possible if the United States, among others, but in a certain sense, unfortunately, I would say, in a primary way, the U.S. plays a very creative and active and sustained role to help make it happen. Let me stop.